Welcome to Season 5 of Kin Folklore, where we have gone through a portal and returned to the world of His Dark Materials for Season 2 of the BBC HBO series based on the novels written by Philip Pullman. Last week, we discussed the deception many of the characters used to advance their needs, the mysteries of Mary Malone's quantum computer, and we talked about the shady practices of the Magisterium.
In this episode, we'll be covering all the demon-changing and world-exploring action of Season 2, Episode 3, entitled The Theft. We'll recap the episode, talk about our observations, and discuss some of the themes, and then we'll look through the Ember Spyglass for some background.
Kinfolk, I call ye and declare ye now. Kinfolk will have adult content. Return. Return. Return.
Oh my gosh, this guy, man. So we'll start out our morning fresh with Will and Lyra. And of course, Lyra is up to some fuck shit, okay?
Already. Like, she just woke up. She's not even had any coffee yet.
Nothing. Pan is trying to talk her down. It's the morning in Chittagatsi. And he's like, listen, we need to stick to the plan. The lithiometer itself told us, stick with Will. We have to help him find his father. Lyra's like, yeah, but you know what I'm going to do? I'm still on this thing about Roger. I need to go find out what happened with Roger. And she flicks a little water on Pan. And, you know, and Pan's like, all right, you sure? You sure? He keeps asking if she's sure. But she, you know, is going to do this. So she is heading back to Oxford to speak to Mary Malone as promised. Meanwhile, Will is struggling with dreams and nightmares about his parents. He wakes up to find that Lyra is gone. When Lyra goes back to find Mary, she is confronted by D.I. Walters.
One of Boreal's minions.
Yes. Compliment, you know, nice mustache. Very, very nice mustache you got going on there.
He just looks creepy.
He does.
I mean, yeah.
I love Lyra's whole, like, energy during this moment. Like, she's like, okay, I'm not going to trip. But can I ask you a question? Like, we're going to talk about what happened in this scene, but why did Mary not hit the fucking elevator button?
I have so many questions about what actually, like, what transpired in this scene. Anyway, I don't want to get, because sometimes, you know me, I get stuck in the, like, why is this happening? Rather than focusing on what is actually happening. And I was like, I don't understand this. Like, why didn't she get in the elevator and just go to a different floor?
That's what I'm saying.
She shoos
her into the elevator to talk to her, and they act like it's an office
where
there's a door.
It's not a closet. It moves. I don't understand.
Hit the button behind you. I'm yelling at the screen, like, push the button, push the button. So, of course, the door opens. Here is D.I. Walters. He's like, both of you, back in the office. And they go. Lyra compliments the mustache. And Walters tries to question Lyra, and she lies about, you know, everything, saying that her name is Lizzie, going down the whole thing that she does.
She's very calm and collected. We know Lyra is a pretty good liar. She's, like, very, yeah. very good. Until
she slips up and snitches by accident. She mentions Will. He's like, where's Will? Oh, yeah, Will's staying there. Oh, damn, you got me. So, confirming that she knows him, D.I. Walters basically is like, hey, Lyra, and knows that it's Lyra now. And so Mary's like, is this really necessary? Starts to, like, run a little interference, which allows Lyra to get out the room. And, you know, they start the escape. While running through the streets of Oxford, Lyra runs right into Boreal in that fresh, upgraded Tesla. The door pops open. Oh, Lizzie, so fine seeing you here. Would you like a lift somewhere? Of course she's like, nah, at first, because he gives off a weird vibe, right? She knows. Part of her's like, nah, I don't really want to be in the car with this dude.
Can I just interject for a moment? Because there's two things I want to note before you move on. One is that when this series is over, I want to create a montage of Lyra running from people. Daphne Keene is basically on a track team. I mean, she is just running. She just runs everywhere. She's constantly being pursued. This is her her thing.
We need to get that cardio up, though, because she was out there looking like Roy Jones and Mike Tyson in an old-timers fight, okay? She was huffing and puffing. Like,
well, you know, it's been, like, a while since she was really on the run. So yeah. The other thing I want to note is that Pan was literally still talking to her in Chittagazi when she zipped up her bag and quieted him. And then as soon as she needs Pan, she opens up that bag. Pan, can you help me? I would have been like, no, I told you not to be here to begin with.
I really can't. There's nothing I'm going to do. And then, but no, dutifully, he turns into a bird and gives her like onboard GPS. He's like, turn left, turn right. There's an alley up ahead. You know what I mean? Like he is, he turned into Siri slash Alexa. That's crazy. Oh, man. So they get into Charles Latcham's car, a.k.a. Boreal. And, you know, Lizzie, a.k.a. Lyra, begins to feel uncomfortable and quickly begs him to let her out. But she forgets her bag. I instantly was like, oh, my God, she doesn't have the bag. Instantly when she gets out.
Yeah.
And Boreal yells out, hey, Lizzie. So she turns around and he gives her back the bag. And just then she reaches into her bag and realizes the alethiometer is gone. And Pan instantly is like,
I told you so.
I told you so. He's like, you are always on this bullshit. He stole it. He's a thief. He knew right away that he had stole the alethiometer. So back in Chittagazi, Will sees a girl run into the building and believes that it's Lyra, so follows the girl back in, but actually it's Angelica, who is gazing out of a window looking at the tower. Will notes that there's someone in the tower, but Angelica tells him there is no way that anyone's in there because there's no way in and there's no way out. But we, as the audience, can clearly see that there is someone standing in the tower, to which Angelica, she basically pulls a great divide in this situation, gaslighting Will like, no, it's probably just a ghost. It's just like, that's you know, no way in, no way out. So he's like, okay, moves on. Will then realizes after he's like kind of going through the kitchen that there's a note there, sees that Lyra has left and gone through the portal again. So he leaves to go catch up with Lyra. He does find her sitting there on the bench, very distraught. And they decide that because they need the alethiometer to find Will's father, they're going to go to Boreal's house, but not before they lay low till nighttime, because obviously, the cops are out. They're looking for them. Will has the smarts. Let's lay low. And they end up going through, going to a movie. I do want to call this part out because it really stuck with me. It's not, is this idea of the moment when they have that conversation, and we can kind of revisit it a little bit in the movie theater. Because right then, that scene in Paddington, you see Paddington cross over into another world. And you could just think, well, it's about them and going through the portal. But I think that's also a moment where there's a real breakthrough in their relationship.
Mm-hmm. 100%. Yeah.
You know?
She tells him about Roger, right?
Yep.
Which is something that she's kind of been hinting at, but never really told him how, you know, how she felt about it and how devastating it was.
Yeah. She reads him for filth. Like legitimately is just like, she basically is like, listen, my friend died. It was my fault. You just came here. You just came because you thought that I was going to just be playing games. But in actuality, I take things very seriously. Don't try to play me like that. And Will kind of feels it like, wow, I overstepped. But I love his comeback when he says to her, and she loves it. Like he says, no, I came because I was worried about you. And now she, that face, I mean, they're just so adorable.
Yeah, the kids have great chemistry. Their relationship to me is very believable.
I agree. I totally agree. So then Will and Lyra catch up with Boreal at his estate.
Estate.
Yeah.
It's an estate. It's not a flat. It's not an apartment. It's not a room.
It's a whole ass mansion. It's a whole ass mansion. Okay? It's crazy. Oh, man. Equipped with artifacts, mahogany wood, a layer inside. There's like a layer that you walk down to get to the bottom to lounge on the couch. It's quite wild. I mean, this guy has done well for himself in our world.
I know.
No question.
We'll talk about this later. I have a lot of questions about Boreal and his riches in our world.
I mean, he I know how it is in the book, but in this series, they have not explained this very well.
No, like, why? Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, man. It's wild. Man, this guy has a Tesla, a mansion.
We were wowed when he had, like, a smartphone. Like, he has a whole mansion.
That's what I'm saying. And they booted his old car. His old car was not a Tesla. Did he just leave that car booted and just went and picked up a new ride?
Listen, I have questions.
Me too. So, you know, he gets him in the house. They question him about the lithiometer. And, you know, he lets on that he knows that they are who they are claiming not to be. He knows that it's Lyra and that his name is Will, and that he was going to offer them a deal, that if they went to Chittagatsi and got a knife from the tower, that he would exchange that the lithiometer for the knife. And that's where the Will and Lyra's portion of the story ends.
So the other main storyline was Lee Scoresby. So early in the episode, a shadowy figure holds a ring and summons Lee Scoresby.
Lee Scoresby, I summon you now and forever and always and ever.
This gave me major Lord of the Rings vibes. I'm just saying.
So weird.
Really strange.
So weird. Like, I get it. They try to make him, he's like a shaman, the whole thing. But he's like flipping, like, it's like, precious. Yeah.
So, Lee wakes up in his balloon to find that he and Hester are off course. They're nearing a town that was in a different direction from where they were heading.
They've been summoned. What are they going to do?
Clearly this being summoned, you know, pulls your GPS and has a gravitational pull.
I need that. I was like, return. Get things to come back. It's great. Anyway.
So Lee does what he always does, which is heads to a local pub where he questions the locals about Grumman. And the locals know who he's talking about. Some say that Grumman is dead. Some say he's a shaman. They tell Lee that Grumman used to work at the observatory in the area. So Lee and Hester head up to the observatory where they encounter a lonely doctor, Dr. Haley. And they're told that Grumman is somewhere up the river. And also that he's a heretic.
Why do you want to know? Grumman is a heretic. By their fruit shall ye know them. By their question shall ye see the serpent naming in their heart.
Why are all the magisterium people so extra?
It's just too much.
It's just too much. Just bring it down a notch, Dr. Haley.
Yeah.
So Haley and his lemur demon become pretty hostile quickly. And Lee and Hester leave. And as they're leaving, their shots fired at them, and Lee returns fire, and he kills Haley in the process.
No, Lee emptied the clip. Lee emptied the fucking clip. He was like, fuck that. I gotta get this guy.
Listen, Lee has been, he's about that life. He's on these streets.
Yeah, exactly. I was a little bit pissed about the lemur. I was very upset that the lemur, listen.
This is ruining Momo's good name.
Exactly.
How dare you?
How dare they depict this lemur even being the same species as the beloved Momo, all right?
Momo would never. Actually, Momo ever. Probably would if that was Sokka. Momo probably would.
Which, to be completely honest, like Lee has a moment that's a very Sokka moment coming up here. Go ahead, continue.
So Lee tries to save the doctor, but he's unable to, and he dies. As they try to escape, they are captured by who I'm assuming are Magisterium forces. It's not entirely clear, but soldiers. Later that day, one of our other characters arrives in the same town. Colty.
Yeah.
Actually, before I move on, do we want to pour one out for Dr. Haley?
Nah. That guy gets not a drop. Not a drop. He's hanging out with Zhao and all the rest of those fuckers. We're not going to do that.
All right. No liquor wasted. Mm-hmm. Later that day, Mrs. Coulter shows up in the town and she hears immediately about Lee's capture. And she goes to see him. And they have a tense conversation, and we're going to talk more in detail about this later, about Lyra and some other things. And in typical Mrs. Coulter fashion, she resorts to violence, but Lee warns her that the trauma of his childhood has given him a high tolerance for pain.
But before they even get to the part about the pain, this is where my boy Lee has a very, very Sokka moment. He was all like, who are you? What do you want? She's like, oh, that's no way to greet somebody. Did you bring food? No. Then who are you? What do you want? I was like, what? Did Sokka just inhabit Lee Scoresby's body? Like, no food? No deal. I'm good. I don't, you know, like, it was great.
Yeah. No, those are the right questions. Who are you? What do you want? Did you bring me something to eat?
Yeah, I agree.
That's the most important thing.
I agree.
The conversation that they have has a profound effect on Mrs. Coulter. She returns to the hotel to find a message from Boreal. He has found Lyra. And Mrs. Coulter's reaction is not happy. She returns to the jail right away. She frees Lee, telling him that if he finds Lyra first, he must protect her. Lee tells Hester they will find a boat and they will continue to seek Grumman. And that's where we left Lee this episode.
And that's why I get so, like there's so much conflict when it comes to Culty. My girl Culty, she has, I know that she's flawed in numerous ways and has done some terribly dark things. And
she literally tortured someone in this episode. But okay, go on.
I'm gonna go on. I know this is danger snack territory. I know this, all right? This is like, I get it. But here's what I'm saying, that she has this like unyielding like obsession, borderline, and you can't tell whether it's just obsession on making sure that Lyra is with her and that Lyra and her are reunited. And I do think that part of it is love. I do think that she loves Lyra, but I also think that, you know, the other parts of her have overshadowed that at moments.
Well, let's just go ahead and talk a little bit more about this conversation that they had.
Yeah.
So yes, I think that she does love Lyra. I think we know that. Yeah. I think we've always known that she loves Lyra. But she didn't set off to find Lyra just out of love, because that's not what she said when she left to the new Cardinal McPhail.
Cardinal McPhail.
Now, she may have not been saying that she was going off to find Lyra when she said that she was looking for something more valuable than Azrael. You know, I think we know from the books that it's not just about finding Lyra. But yeah. I often question if Mrs. Coulter can separate her love from Lyra for what she thinks Lyra is worth. And yeah. I think Lee questions that here too. He tells her, you love her, but that's not how it works. Love isn't always enough.
Mm-hmm.
He's very clearly challenging Mrs. Coulter's notion that being Lyra's mother is the thing that is going to keep her from putting Lyra in harm's way.
And yeah, outward says so. When she says, I'm her mother, and he says so. You know what I mean?
Because she tries to shame him. Mr. Scoresby, are you a parent? And he says no. Well, how can you possibly understand? Well, his retort is, I don't need to be a parent. I'm in this for Lyra because I love that little girl, and her life is worth 10 of mine. And he says to Mrs. Coulter, I don't think you understand the worth, what lives are worth. And I think that's very, very true. He also calls her on her turning kids into essentially zombies and questions whether or not her love is enough. Being a parent enough when you're willing to do something so horrible to other people's kids? And if we look at the other parents, not Azrael, because, you know, he's a failure as a man and a failure as a mother. But if we look at Ma Costa, we could never imagine Ma Costa sacrificing another child, even if it had saved her own child.
Agreed.
And certainly not just to experiment on them.
Agreed.
So I think Lee is really on to something about Mrs. Coulter's intentions. He reads her immediately.
Yeah. And I think like that you know, that idea about, you know, love, even if you don't have children of your own, is also illustrated with Mary, right? Mary mm-hmm. is, you know, she's still struggling to get the cave to speak to her in the way that it speaks to Lyra. But the question she asks, it shows that she loves, she cares about where is Lyra. She says, is Lyra safe? That's her primary concern. She's been dealing with this machine for how long without having a breakthrough? And instead of being like trying to just answer the questions that get to her own scientific breakthrough or even metaphysical breakthrough, she's wondering if Lyra is okay. And that shows you that there is a difference between just like, oh, because that's your parent, that it just automatically means that it's about love for you to find this person.
Mm-hmm.
Without Lyra, Dr. Malone is still trying to speak to the cave. She starts to read on the art of the I Ching, and the ancient text tells her that to the mind that is still, the whole universe surrenders. And it's a revelation. She has a revelation in that moment. Because it's something that she's thinking about, that concept going back to the previous episode of how Lyra explained that she was able to do what she was saying. And it's this kind of idea of putting your mind in a state that allows you to be able to have this communication with dust. Mm-hmm. And so it's really interesting, interesting take on that. And then kind of brings us to another concept about like kind of home. And where home is, I think that's another notable moment in this episode when you start looking at what the witches are going through and their home. What were your takes on that, Andrea?
Okay, so we didn't cover the witches in the summary, and that's in part because the witches aren't really a big part of this episode in the ways that they were in previous episodes. And I think that that's just because it's showing us that the witches are quite devastated from the attack that the Magisterium lobbied against them last week, but also that they're keeping their mind in they're not distracted by what the Magisterium did. They're still focused on the prophecy and mm-hmm. protecting Lyra. And so I think that that is really important in a lot of ways for the story, but it shows me a lot about the witches. Like, their homeland was destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we also get in this episode a lovely cameo by our favorite armored bear.
Yeah.
Which was really awesome. I was not expecting to see Yorick at all in this season.
So a little controversial about that, right? Like, that's a little controversial to me. Like, why is Yorick here? But I liked it too. I liked it too.
I liked it. But he's not in the book. So it was an unexpected surprise.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked what they did with it. So like, Yorick gets a visit from Kaisa, who wants to know what happened to Lyra, because Yorick was like thorough from Azrael's manservant, was mm-hmm. one of the last people to see Lyra. And in that conversation, quite a bit is revealed, right? So mm-hmm. Yorick is really struggling, right? The bears are struggling with food, the mountains are melting, Azrael's hole in the sky that he created really put the world in disarray. But in addition to that, Kaisa is basically like, they killed most of our people and destroyed our homeland, but we are not going to let this go. We're not distracted. They have not diminished what we're going to do. We still need to find Lyra because it is her destiny that is most important.
But what I found interesting in that conversation is, again, the idea of people who are in search of Lyra because of her destiny versus people who genuinely love her and want to search for her. Not to say that the witches don't care for her, but Yorick's response to that is, so Lyra is your toy in your future, set on a course that she can't change. And he was bothered by that. You could tell that there was a part of him, his voice got elevated a little bit, and then Kaisa had to retort a little bit to say, hey, no, that's not exactly what I'm saying, to kind of move the conversation along. But I think this also displays this kind of tug-pull yeah. between the relationships and the ways that people perceive her, because Yorick very much understands this by having complicated kind of relationships with his own destiny and how he loves Lyra for Lyra. He doesn't love Lyra because she serves some purpose in a prophecy.
Yeah, 100%. And Kaisa doesn't really say to him, we care about her. What he says is everybody's destiny is tied up in Lyra's, which yep. is basically like, you're telling me that your people are starving.
Mm-hmm.
If we're all going to survive, we have to make sure that Lyra completes her destiny. And he says, I think he says something like, we're all beholden to the fates. Mm-hmm. I mean, this gave me, I hate to bring up the work of She Who Shall Not Be Named. But this gave me big Dumbledore vibes. Like Harry has to do this thing that is horrible and is going to be difficult for him, but he can't know that he has to do it until he's about to do it. And we should talk in another episode about like choice, right? Because a lot of that is about Harry made choices, and Lyra makes choices too. Although I think she has at this point far less information than Harry did. But
this
conversation between Kaisa and Yorick was gave a lot of information, actually, despite the fact that it was unexpected to book readers and just a cameo for Yorick.
I loved it. And the thing about the fates made me think about, when you thought about Potter, made me think about Vikings. I know like we have some fans of that show that listen to this show too, and just in general. But Vikings, like it was a callback to like that pagan sense of like the fates and this other like kind of like how your life has a destiny. Like there is, it's this whole thing, this conversation that's happened a lot in pop culture later recently, between like determinism and free will and this idea around these things. And I think like the fates in that culture that's depicted in that show, Vikings, is very much about like, there's a destiny. Your life has this destiny and there isn't anything that you're going to be able to do to sway that. And you have to follow that through. No matter how many ways you try to change it, it's going to land you in the spot that you were fated to be in. And so I think like that's a callback also to that kind of pagan sensibility of the fates and what Kaisa is saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. I can see that too. And so should we talk a little bit about the other part of Mrs. Coulter and Lee's conversation?
Yeah, I thought it was really, really powerful that, you know, Lee basically tells the story of his parentage and uses it as a reason why he knows that he'll never, you know, give up Lyra and where she is to Mrs. Coulter, and says that, you know, I won't either, because you are similarly built like me. That basically he had a high tolerance for pain due to abuse that he suffered from his father's hands. And he realizes that it was more than possible that Mrs. Coulter also has this same kind of lineage of trauma in her family line, and that he basically triggers something in her. And mm-hmm. Mrs. Coulter realizes that what he's saying, for me, the way I read it was that she realizes what he's saying is accurate, that he's not going to break and she's not going to get what she wants. And in fact, she's not sure what to do with him in that moment and just leaves and kind of, you know, break. I know this isn't supposed to be funny, but she puts herself in the corner.
Yeah.
No, she literally just like goes to the wall, puts herself in the corner. And it's really the first time that I've seen the golden monkey, like really in her, have a moment where there's some comforting that's happening. Mm-hmm. Like, honestly, like there's a moment where the golden monkey is comforting her in a sense. And that's because of that. The you know, her demon's been with her throughout all of that abuse. So there's something to this story that's revealed, that Mrs. Coulter has had a very traumatic childhood, as has Lee, and that shared pain, along with their care, whatever side of the care that they're on of Lyra, builds this kind of like understanding that allows her not to go any further with the pain that she's trying to inflict.
Yeah, I mean, I think I definitely felt the same way about this conversation. I loved it. I thought this was the best part of this episode. Although I also thought that Mary Malone's parts of the episode were really moving to and building out her character a little bit more than it is mm-hmm. in the book. Mm-hmm. But this stuff is really powerful and gives us depth to their characters we wouldn't normally have. I also thought the fact that the golden monkey and Hester both comforted Lee and Mrs. Coulter after a conversation that was painful. Not that they actually experienced the trauma again firsthand, but just talking about the trauma that they experienced as children, their demons had to comfort them. And Hester said to Lee, "You haven't talked about him in a while." And Lee, it takes everything out of Lee to have this conversation with Mrs. Coulter.
Agreed.
He's basically spent after this. And Mrs. Coulter, who sometimes does lose her stuff, like we in season one, she had some real moments. There was, I held my breath when she put her head against the wall and the golden monkey was kind of lingering behind her, hoping that the golden monkey was going to take her hand and that she would take it. Because the golden monkey has tried to comfort her in the past, and she doesn't always allow herself to be comforted.
Exactly.
So I thought it was really moving that both demons did exactly what, you know, people need to do to get through trauma, which is comfort themselves.
Yeah.
Be, you know, hold yourself tight because you need a moment to gather yourself after you know, essentially are experiencing the trauma again. I love this scene. I thought in the acting in this scene, I'll probably take some flack from people. I don't think Lin-Manuel is always great in this show. I thought he was great in this scene. This was a really powerful scene for both of them.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that there was clarity in the acting about what they want. And there was clarity in the writing about what they want. And I think when you have those two things mixed, it makes for a powerful scene and it makes for a powerful exchange. And those two characters, it's kind of clear, like, you know, what they're wanting in this moment, you know, to and that there's like a stalemate based on the fact that they recognize the counterpoint of like what they in each other of what they've experienced. And they're like, oh, okay. It actually was kind of wild to see Mrs. Coulter kind of disarmed with her normal anger and her ability to inflict pain the way that she has, that we've seen numerous times on anyone, that she, and get answers that she wants. I mean, we just saw two episodes ago her picking out Cloudpine and getting really close to getting more answers than what the witches would have wanted her to have about Lyra's importance. And it's so for her to be stopped in her tracks shows that there's something here that we're going to explore throughout this season.
Yeah, and I just also want to say the only person I've seen have this effect on her in the past is really Lyra.
Yep.
When Lyra challenged her about being angry was the only time we've really seen her, in front of someone else anyway, lose it. I mean, she did go crazy after the witches tore up her whole lab in Bullvanger, but you know, this reaction that Lee got from her, we haven't seen her get this emotional, you know, often. I think Lyra has a profound effect on her. I think Asriel does. And Lee, who she's speaking to for the first time, kind of strips her bare.
Yeah. I mean, to say you love her, and she says, of course I do. And then to have the follow-up that we spoke about earlier of like, it's not enough. Like, we know that it, you know, it doesn't mean you won't hurt her, and it doesn't mean that she's safe with you. So I'm never going to give you where this little girl is. Not a chance. Like, it means too much for me to do it. And I think she recognizes, oh man, this is a real one. He's definitely not. You know what I mean? Like, so it's solid. I think the last notable part of this that, you know, as a movie guy myself, that misses being in a theater. Do those things even exist anymore? It's weird. I don't even know. To see Lyra and Will walking through the theater and to see that there were multiple open seats and that they decided to walk in front of the unsuspecting couple that was sitting there just watching the Paddington movie. I was like, guys, there was a whole row behind them. What are you doing? And then I don't know why you had to walk in front of them. But then they do. And then Lyra like starts munching on the popcorn and then talks shit about the popcorn.
I was so insulted. I was like, how? First of all, everyone knows that movie theater popcorn is like the best popcorn.
It's magical.
And how dare you, Lyra? How dare you? I was so insulted.
But she showed that she was full of it because she goes, it tastes like wood shavings. And Willow's like, well, then stop eating my shit. And she's like, I can't. Exactly. Because it's good. You just don't know what it is. It's good. Anyway.
I would be completely, completely wrong if I did not call out the Downton Abbey crossover that I never thought I needed. But there he was. Lord Grantham in the Paddington movie.
Oh, so good. So
I
good.
I like actually sat up because I actually have not seen the Paddington movies.
Yeah.
But I sat up and I was like, it's Lord Grantham.
Yeah. You didn't just sit up. You text me. You were like, Lord Grantham makes an appearance. I was like, what? That's amazing. Yeah, I was hyped. I was so hyped. I looked for it the whole time. I was like, through the whole episode. And then I realized, I was like, oh, there he is. There it is. It's great. It's great. So
Robert Crawley. I always need a Robert Crawley, the Earl of Grantham appearance and everything. I just love Downton Abbey. Anyway. Yeah.
We both do. The show that, oh my God, I love that show. Anyway, so I am going to eat my irresistible popcorn, and I hope you guys do the same as we take a little moment to look through the amber spyglass at some themes and some ideas or characters that we may want to look a little bit closer at. So this week, the show introduced a bunch of theories about Stanislaus Grumman, the man who is known as a scholar in Lyra's world, but is also a previously an explorer in Will's world. Grumman and John Perry are one and the same, and yet we don't know how he crossed between the worlds. Did he take the same path that Will did? What happened, right? But we do know that he did so about 12 years ago and never returned. Perry set off on a dig expedition to Alaska. The aim of the expedition was to survey an area for evidence of early human settlements. But Perry was in search of an anomaly that was rumored to be in the area. A few weeks after this departure, Perry and some of the other members of the expedition disappeared. This is likely when Perry crossed over in Lyra's world. We expect that the show will tell us if Perry visited other worlds as well as we continue on. While in Lyra's world, Perry worked as a scholar at Jordan College under the name Stanislaus Grumman, and then set off for the north where he once again disappeared during an exploration. As Lee hears in the tavern, it seems that he was injured badly at some point and has become known, at least by the magisterium, as a heretic. As Lee Scoresby discovers, he worked for some time in the north at the observatory and perhaps became a shaman. Although his family in Will's world has every reason to believe that John Perry is dead, it is Asriel who introduces the idea that Grumman is dead when he shows up at Jordan with a skull that he claims is Grumman's. This could be Grumman.
It was a block of ice, man. How could they know if it was Grumman?
It's just so weird. And that part always stuck with me. I was like, this guy is like, no, it's just a block. It's a block of ice. That's it. Lee Scoresby, however, knows that Grumman's skull would have some rare anomalies, and this is part of why he's on his quest, I guess. That's part of it. Like, he knows that, hey, this guy has some answers. What do you think?
Well, I think that he's in search of this magical object that Grumman has, right? Mm-hmm. Which they haven't really told us what it is. I suspect that he thinks that Grumman has a subtle knife.
Or one ring to rule them all.
But we know that Grumman isn't an average looking guy. There's some things about him that make some of the scholars wonder if that's really him. Like, it's not super clear. They're not sold that it's Grumman just because Asriel says it is. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder if Lee believes that Grumman is alive because he knows something about Grumman that Asriel maybe didn't know or understand. I don't think it's entirely clear, to be honest. I think this is a part of the plot that is much better outlined in the book. Mm-hmm. It's not really clear to me in the show. Maybe I'm missing some of the subtext, but it just seemed like from the first episode, he just decided he had to find Grumman.
Yeah.
And I don't really, I'm not entirely sure where Lee was supposed to get this idea from.
And I would say that there's things that were cut from the adaptation in this season that, and so far, that I think are good that they got rid of. And, you know, I think, okay, that's probably, it kind of went on too long. And then there's things that like really deepen the journey. And I think that some of the shorthand that we've gotten with Lee Scoresby's journey kind of undermines how powerful this journey is so far. And hopefully they go deeper in that in future episodes, because there's a lot that kind of unravels in his journey to getting to Stanislaus Grumman. And you don't want to lose that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So, and a lot of the information about where Grumman has been and where he was going is in those chapters that got consolidated.
Yeah.
So like when in the book, Lee doesn't just meet with one doctor, right? He speaks to a number of scholars, and they talk to him about where Grumman, what Grumman was doing, what he was looking into, you know, why the Magisterium kind of put him on their radar, like he got on their radar. And mm-hmm. so I just think that and also just that he's like a mysterious guy.
He's a shaman. Like, and he's a shaman because he lived amongst people who were shamans. Like, right? So they say it and then they just throw that away. Like, oh, I heard he was a shaman. So I hope they go deeper into that too, right? Like, well,
yeah, I think they will, because I think the part with the ring was like mentioned,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But not, it wasn't explicit in the book in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think the Lee stuff has always been kind of tricky. I don't know if they really fully understand Lee Scoresby's character.
Yeah.
You know, like I think you said it last season that the stuff with Lee didn't make a lot of sense towards the end.
Yeah.
And I think that's some of that's happening here. But on the flip side, this show has done a wonderful job giving Lee like emotional complexity that he didn't have.
I agree.
So, we'll see.
And they've also clearly let us know, which in the show, that the journey that Lee is on is dangerous. That mm-hmm. it's not just a journey just to go. He's met all kinds of obstacles before this, but now, like, people have tried to kill him multiple times now
mm-hmm.
in this episode. So it's a dangerous journey that he's on.
Mm-hmm. And I think adding Mrs. Coulter to the mix at this point is also, you know, it upped the stakes a little bit.
Agreed.
Because now it's like, is Lee going to catch up to Lyra before Mrs. Coulter does? Do the witches catch up first? Does Lee get back with the witches? Like, I think they have set up like a number of possibilities for the show.
Mm-hmm.
So I think some of it's good. I'm not always clear that they're communicating what they think they are.
Yeah.
But
I agree.
We'll have to see. So the theme for this week was intentions. And this is like a regular theme through the episode. When Lyra heads back to Oxford to speak to Mary Malone, her intentions seem very pure, right?
Mm-hmm.
She wants to go learn more about dust. And we knew this about Lyra. That's why she went through the portal to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted to seek dust. But the alethiometer told her to let that go.
Yep.
And Pan is telling her, you got to let that go. But Lyra wants to do what she thinks is right in that moment. So that's what she does. She rarely thinks about the consequences of her actions. We know this about Lyra. this is who she is. She can be impulsive. And that problem, this episode, causes her to lose the most powerful tool that she has.
Yep.
And it renders her intentions meaningless because she actually went without Will because it was going to be dangerous for him. And now she has put herself and Will in more danger.
Mm-hmm.
And she has lost the thing that gave them an advantage over the Magisterium.
And it's so close to what she did with Roger, right? Like this whole thing, like she had to do this, she was gonna do this, everything that happened, and it led Roger right into a trap. Well, now we're seeing, well, how are they gonna, you know, transform this situation? Because essentially Lyra is part of what's going on in Boreal's mind, but Will is really what's happening and why it's important for Boreal. And Lyra inadvertently has now led Will right into a trap for Boreal, right there. Like, they got to go get this knife now. he's got to get just to get the elite theometer. And we all know Boreal has no intention of giving them anything.
No, that's not how he functions.
No.
And, you know, clearly Mrs. Coulter doesn't trust him.
Yeah.
Because as soon as she gets that note, she's alarmed.
Yeah.
So we've talked before about Mrs. Coulter's intentions, and they're still unclear. We talked about this a little bit earlier. You know, she said to Cardinal MacPhail that she was in search of a tool that was more powerful, yada, yada, yada. But she does seem genuinely concerned about Lyra's welfare, and she clearly wants to protect her from nefarious actions like Boreal. Mm-hmm. But I do still have this question. Is Lyra just the daughter who she loves, or is she also thinking of Lyra as a potential weapon that she can use? Mm-hmm. It seems clear that Mrs. Coulter's not sure about this. I mean, mm-hmm. when Lee sort of challenges her on this, she doesn't really have a good answer aside, I'm her mother, and of course I love her.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that I trust that love enough either.
Well, let's think about this. If we go with our theory from last week, and she did have parentage from the witches, she would be familiar enough, maybe partially anyway, with this prophecy. And she mentions the prophecy. The witches say there's a prophecy, blah, blah, blah. Which she would have found out in the first episode through her torture thing that she did. But it could be that she has a little bit more knowledge than we, even as an audience, know as to what Lyra potentially could be if she is, in fact, the child in the prophecy. And I think you're right. There's reason to doubt whether or not everything, her intentions are clear, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you brought up the witches, because we don't really understand their intentions. You know, I think I'm on record as being a big fan of the witches mm-hmm. in this world, but the witches have been almost single-minded. Seraphina's witches mm-hmm. have been almost single-minded. Ruta Scotti is very clear that she has one thing on her agenda too, mm-hmm. which is putting the magisterium in its place.
Yep.
And so I think that it's worth noting that the witches' intentions are also unclear, because they seem to just be interested in Lyra for her destiny in the prophecy as well. Or do they have a deeper concern for her? Like, we don't know the full prophecy, right? We've heard this prophecy mostly through Kaisa's words, right? The show uses Kaisa as the sort of narrator for the prophecy. But we don't always know the full extent of the prophecy. And so if it's a choice between Lyra's future happiness and the prophecy, my guess is the witches are going to lean into the prophecy.
Yep.
But we'll have to see. But Lyra has some characters whose intentions seem very pure to her.
Ride or die. We call them, they're in the Uncle Iroh category. These are the Uncle Iroh characters.
Mm-hmm. So we have Lee Scoresby, who mm-hmm. essentially was like, I legit will die for her.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what you do to me. Mary Malone, who she literally just met, but has done through all of this, even though she knows that Lyra is the key to her own discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And so this thing that she's been working on for probably her entire academic life. She's only been concerned with Lyra's welfare. And obviously Yurik.
Mm-hmm.
Yurik, his first thing is like, oh, so like you just want to use Lyra as
bait, basically.
A pawn?
Yeah, basically you're using her as a pawn. Exactly right.
And so what I would like to see is, you know, will join this trio that isn't currently working together, but will join this trio and an ally who truly cares about Lyra for who she is, or mm-hmm. because he sees her as a means to an end. Right now, Lyra is the person who has the alethiometer, which will help him find his father.
Mm-hmm.
He does seem to put her first when she loses the alethiometer. He's like, we need to get back to Chittagazi. It's not safe for us here.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if will continue to put Lyra first.
Yeah, I think there was a real breakthrough for that in this episode. I think Lyra proved something here to Will in her ability to be vulnerable and tell her portion of her story before he met her in a way that she was not really wanting to do or able to do when they first met. Like, she didn't even want to be around the guy, and Pan had to convince her. So I think like that made a difference in their dynamic. And then I also think that Lyra's gonna have to swallow her idea that she's the star of the show. Like, she's going to have to. Like, there's a part of her that is. She is the center in this story, as we know. But she's also going to have to listen to the Elite Theometer and partner with Will in this portion of the journey that the Elite Theometer is clearly saying is important to both of their journey and what they're after. So she's going to have to figure that out, too, and not put herself in harm's way as consistently.
Yeah, I mean, Lyra's always been a little bit single track. Mm-hmm. I mean, in fairness to Lyra, when she did let herself get distracted, right, mm-hmm. when she was with Mrs. Coulter, she regretted it. Mm-hmm. Because she had initially been very concerned about Roger, and then Mrs. Coulter kind of distracted her. And she, you know, wasn't as focused on what was going on with him and the gobblers. Mm-hmm. So I understand why Lyra sometimes gets, like, stuck. But, you know, intentions are not enough. Wanting to do the right thing is in love, those things don't always get you where you need to go.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to look at the big picture. And I think Lyra lost track of that this week. And, you know, her and Will are paying the price for it. Boreal is not like, he's not like a run-of-the-mill villain.
No.
You know, like.
No.
He will do things. We've already seen him basically stalk Will's mother. We've already seen that he will let his minions resort to violence when he feels the need. And so, you know, this is a little alarming now that they're kind of stuck in his web again.
Yeah. And I think that what you're hitting on, too, about intentions, it reminds me of the theme that was constantly visited in a lot of the Marvel movies and especially the Avengers, how, you know, just because, and through Iron Man's arc, just because you're the hero, you're trying to do the right thing, doesn't mean there's unintended consequences to other people's lives and things that can come from it. So it's real important to have clarity that just because your intentions are good doesn't mean the outcome's going to be good. And I think Lyra is finding that out right now. She's in the midst of, that's why you see her so defiant at the end of the episode. We're going to get your knife. And she doesn't even know what that means, but she's defiantly saying, and she's going to keep learning this lesson that just because you think you're doing the right thing, it may not actually lead to where you think you're going, you know? And that's going to be interesting for her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found all of the subtext in this episode about intentions and who is intending to do what. Like, I think we've always stood by the fact that Asriel and Mrs. Coulter think they're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
No matter who it hurts.
Yep.
And we've seen the consequences of that. Their daughter can be the same. Yeah. She can be. She gets stuck. She gets stuck in, like, what she believes to be right. And sometimes it puts other people in harm's way.
Well, you know, when I was reading The Golden Compass and I went and I read the whole book and then I got to the end at the scene where, you know, Asriel and Mrs. Coulter have this whole, like, you know, dialogue back and forth about how they feel about each other and everything we saw at the end of season one. And by the time it was done and then Lyra's like, I'm going through the portal and leaves Roger's dead body there, I was like, you know what? I'm out on this whole family.
You were. You really were. You were like, throw the whole family away.
Yeah.
This whole family is garbage. Yeah. And I was like, hold on. Lyra has her moments.
Yeah.
But, like, yeah, I mean, She can be rather thoughtless, but she is also, I think that thoughtlessness and that not thinking about the consequences is actually also what just makes her courageous.
Yeah, agreed. And I say that to say, like, thank God you encouraged me, because The Subtle Knife was like I love that book. I love that book more than I love the first book. You know what I mean? Like, so mm-hmm. it's
me too. Yeah. I think for me, that was when I was really in on the series, was when I read The Subtle Knife. And Lyra really, in the book, she really does grow and gain a lot of empathy that we hadn't previously seen from her.
100%. Agreed.
So,
agreed.
Yeah. It's been interesting to watch this on screen. As I said earlier, I think these two have great chemistry, and I'm actually super excited to see them go through some more challenges together and, like, really go through a challenge, because so far their biggest challenge has been running from Popo.
Yeah. And I just want to shout out and talk to Amir's agent. You guys keep putting him in roles where he's got like these letters and he has to like find someone with the letters. Like, I made a letter for the king. This role, I mean, this, let's not typecast this kid. He's got a very bright future, okay? Like, let's, next role, no letters involved, please. That's all I got.
He is like a real, it's really good casting. Yeah. I think the show nailed the casting.
Agreed.
I really do. And like, he is not who I ever imagined Will Parry to be. I always imagined Will Parry to be like kind of a nerdy younger kid. Mm-hmm. I mean, they also aged him up a little bit.
Definitely.
But he works. It works. He's got the same like street smart, subtle, like understated acting. Mm-hmm. Like he's really just he's good as Will Parry. Yeah. I like him a lot. I think all the casting is pretty good, except for I'm not a huge fan of Azrael, but it might just be I'm out on Azrael's whole
cast. I mean, the actor's really good, but Azrael is just, yeah, he's a failure as a man and a failure as a father. All right? It just is what it is. There's no getting around it. Well, that is our show for today. We look forward to covering this season of His Dark Materials continuously until the end. We'll be back next week, Thursday. Until then, hit us up on all the social channels, Kin Folklore Pod, on both Instagram and Twitter, Kin Folklore on Facebook, and send us a little line. Drop us an email, kinfolklore@gmail.com, and leave us some reviews. We'd love to hear your feedback about the show. And who knows, even give us some thoughts. We have a thought brewing about this hate watch, but you know, just hit us up. Let us know what you think.
Thanks, everyone.